This episode is brought to you by Boast.ai. Each year, the US and Canadian governments give out billions of dollars in R&D tax credits and innovation incentives to fund businesses like yours. But the application process is cumbersome, prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money can take up to 16 months. Boast.ai gets you access to research and development tax credits and innovation funding opportunities without the headache and red tape. Join thousands of North American companies leveraging Boast.ai software to maximize cashback. Check out www.boast.ai.
Whether you're in customer development or have a few customers, generally what you want to do is, so suppose you're like going from ideation, you have a first set of conversations with customers to validate that the problem is real, right? The second set of customer conversations is that you go and like show them some potential solution to that problem. And they go, you know what, if you build this, I think it's definitely going to solve the problem. Then you start trying to convert some of those folks into design partners. I've alluded to it earlier. That is where the sales start. And what I mean by that is that it's not enough for a customer to have the pain point and like your solution. Fundamentally, especially if you're trying to like get some paid engagement with that customer, you're going to have to go through their buying motion anyway. So at that point is when I think what you have to do is qualify.
I need some traction. You need some traction.
Hey, what's up, innovators, entrepreneurs, visionaries, and disruptors? This is your Traction Podcast host, Lloyd Lobo. We're a community of over 100,000 people, just like yourself, on a mission to help you get the methods, the money, and the madness to explode your business growth. Featuring stories and tactical advice straight from those who've done it before, like Shopify, Twilio, Asana, and many more.
All right, excited for another traction session here. Building a repeatable, scalable sales org is super hard, but is the holy grail in B2B SaaS. And our guest today has done it a few times. Bokar is a thought leader within the GTM landscape, being a sales coach at Harvard Business School, at revenue.fyi, and scaling to 100.com. He was an early employee at Hootsuite, starting as a sales rep pre-revenue, leading multiple GTM teams through its growth to 150 million ARR, 1,500 plus employees, and 300 million plus in funding. Today, as a managing director at Forum Ventures, Bokar supports 30 plus early stage founders each year on a one-on-one basis to help them establish their target customers, gaining rapid traction, establishing sales motions in the early days of a startup. So that 0 to 1 sales. Welcome to Traction, Bokar. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Glad to be here and thanks for having me.
Awesome. I'm super excited to finally get this on the road. Firstly, give us your backstory. How did you get into sales, specifically startup sales?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I always wanted to be in tech. And I think my younger self thought that the only way you could do that would be to go to university and get a computing degree. And I did do that. But the reality is that I realized that I didn't want to be a software developer. I ended up being very lucky that I joined a company that ended up being pretty successful. You mentioned I was early at Hootsuite. So I was in the first kind of 10 employees and one of the first sales reps pre-revenue, and just fell in love with the business side of tech more so than the technical side of tech. And for me, it was interesting because I think I'm glad that I have a technical background, because I tend to think of sales and go to market in more of a scientific way. I'm not one of those that believe that selling is an art. I actually believe that it is more of a science than anything else. And that's really how it started. So I was early at Hootsuite. I joined right when we were launching our enterprise product. Then I ended up, it wasn't on purpose at first, but then it was. But then I ended up really helping launch a lot of our new verticals, new products. So I've lived in that 0 to 1 million, 0 to 10 million ARR kind of world for the better part of the last 15 years, touched multiple models from PLG all the way to large enterprise. I was a founder at some point as well, but fast forward to today, I'm a partner at Forum Ventures, where I help founders exactly with that 0 to 1 and 1 to 10 kind of selling motion.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So let's dive right into the 0 to 1. I have an idea. No product.
Yeah.
How do you recommend I get my first customers?
That's a good question. So here's maybe what I'll, let me paint the picture and tell me if this sounds familiar, right? So you work at a company and you identify a problem, right? Maybe it's because you're trying to buy technology to help you solve a problem and the technology didn't exist. And you think, okay, I think there is a business here. Let me look into it. And that's your idea. What tends to happen is that you'll go and talk to other folks in your network. Suppose that this was a product management product or solution. You go and talk to a bunch of other product managers, 3, 4, 5. They have the same problem and you decide you're going to build this product. You work with them as design partners, build the product, raise some funding, and I could keep going. Here's the problem with that approach. Everything that I just said probably sounds familiar to a lot of people, right? And it sounds right when you think about it. The reality is the first thing that you actually have to really figure out, especially if you're trying to build a venture scale business, is whether there is enough customers in the world to turn this idea into an actual venture scale business. So I'll repeat that because I think it's worth repeating. This is fundamentally, I think the biggest mistake that founders make is day one, where you don't actually do the work of actually not just validating that the problem is real, but validating that there is enough customers in the world that experience the problem to actually justify a venture scale outcome. So one of the first things that I actually do with my companies is that I hear the idea and I go, okay, in my mind, it's really a hypothesis. Go and talk to 30, 40, 50 customers to validate that the problem is real and that this is something that they're willing to spend your money on. But more importantly, and this is what every VC does, by the way, early stage, instead of looking at just the size of the market top down, really do the work of actually doing the bottom-up sizing of this market to get an estimate of, given this problem, how many potential customers are there in the world? And given how much I'm going to charge them, what does that market opportunity look like? Because half the time when I do this exercise, what tends to happen is that founders will look at it and go, oh, this is only a $300 million TAM opportunity, not the $10 billion TAM opportunity that I thought about. So what I would say is, the first thing when you've got an idea is, yes, validate the idea, but there's two words in problem market, product market fit. There's product and market. Just make sure that you're validating the market part of that idea as well.
A lot of people don't validate the market. I have a funny story, right? I graduated engineering and I didn't want to work in this 9-to-5 engineering kind of landscape. I was always on the other side of risk as a rebellious kid. And so I asked somebody, hey, what's the best skill I could learn if I want to be in business someday? And they said, communication. Now I know I'm not super self-motivated, meaning self-motivated is not showing up when the conditions are perfect. It's showing up when you're repeatedly punched in the gut. And I knew that if I wanted to fix my communication and learn public speaking, the first time 4 people laughed at me, I wouldn't show up. So I'm like, probably the best way to learn how to improve my communication skills is to put myself in a job that forces me to communicate day in, day out. So I started applying to sales jobs. Nobody would hire this awkward engineer. Luck would have it, a founder who needed cold callers hired me, and I got the opportunity to work alongside him. And there my journey started, from sales or cold calling for a startup to then being an AE and then sales leader for a startup and then being VP sales and marketing and then eventually hitting a ceiling and then starting my own thing. But that was my journey. So it's very fascinating, right? I think it's one of the best jobs you can do is put yourself in a position where you're part of selling in an early stage company, because you're polishing your messaging, you're pivoting on the fly, you're learning to negotiate, you're running alongside the founder. You're basically creating the playbooks. You get so good at it that you eventually become good at creating, right? And a lot of what you do as a founder is, one, communicating, and two, creating. And the third thing, of course, is being consistent or showing up repeatedly. So I love that example there. Now let's dive right in, right? So what are the key steps to identifying your target customer? Like, how do you do this to make sure you've validated, one,
yeah,
there's a market need, but two, is a sizable market. Maybe it might be a small niche, but it grows into something massive tomorrow. What are some key elements that you use to validate that?
Yeah, let me maybe at a high level introduce a framework, because you're talking about your book, and when you think about building community and how the steps are pretty much the same every time, right? I do see a pattern when it comes to how you build something from zero to one, right? From a go-to-market standpoint. I think of it as a multi-stage process. Maybe it's too many stages, but I think of 5 stages at a high level. We just talked about the first one, which is you've got an idea, confirm that there's a real market pain there. And what I mean by that is that it's not just like confirming that the problem is real, but confirming that the market pain is big enough to justify a venture scale outcome, right? How do you do that? You go and talk to 20, 30, 40, 50 customers to just really make sure that what you think is a pain point is a real pain point. It actually is the case across the board. And you're also making sure that the pain point is important enough for somebody to actually spend money or do something to address that problem, right? Because if you don't have that, then you're never going to get a sale in the first place, right? At this point, you still, if I think about the product, you still don't need to build product. You can have the conversations. You might have some slides. You might have other things. But note that going back to communication, what you're talking about, even as a tech founder, I am not coding just yet. All I'm doing is having conversations with customers, right? So say you've done step one. So you've gone there. You now at this point have an idea, if you talk to 30, 40, 50 customers, of what industry they belong in, right? What's the revenue range? What's the employee count? What are the key challenges? What's their typical stack? And what you're doing really is that you're starting to build an ICP when you think about it, right? Then based on your ICP, you extrapolate it, think about your market sizing, and then you can calculate your TAM and other things. So that's step one. So stage one is you validated that there is a real market pain. Then what you actually need to do is, okay, how do I go from this to building a product, which leads you to really narrowing in on the specific high priority problems within that bigger realm of problems while you're doing this, because what you're trying to get at is, what is my minimum viable feature set, minimum viable product that's going to be solving for this, right? How do you get to that? Again, I'm going to start sounding like a broken record, because guys, you have to talk to customers again, right? So the first conversation was really just validating that this is real. The second conversation is really digging into those high priority specific problems. And the way in which you might do this at this point is, on a product side, now you've got some insights, you've got some simple kind of mock-ups, you've got some things that you're showing, you still haven't written a single line of code, right? So that's stage two, right? Stage three is when you actually now start looking at, okay, so I've talked to 30, 40, 50 customers. Out of the 30, 40, 50 customers, the pain was the most acute with this 10, right? This, by the way, is where your actual sales cycle should start. I know that you've had 2 customer conversations and it feels like you've done the discovery and some type of demo already, but fundamentally, you're in customer development. You're not in sales yet. In my mind, you're not in a sales cycle until you've actually qualified this customer, which is when you actually start making sure that this is a customer that's willing and able to actually be your design partner, right? Which is kind of the step that you're in now, which is phase three. You're designing, iterating on a solution to address those problems, and you're trying to drive those customer conversations to design partner status, right? Once you've done that, you're working with your list of 5-10 design partners to launch V1. You work closely with them, build V1. And the next step after that is that you've got a working product that's already showing some signs of success and you're actually delivering some value. Then you actually start selling into early adopters and so on. I've described the process and I haven't said that you're PLG or that you're SMB focused or that you're large enterprise focused, because fundamentally, the steps are the same. You go from confirming that there's a real market pain all the way to selling to your early adopters, whoever those early adopters are. And that's maybe just kind of one thing that I think about at a high level when you do this, because fundamentally, this is also what helps you build the right foundations for your go-to-market motion as well. And that's something that I can expand on. But the reality is, most of the time, you're not really building product until you get to that stage 3 that I talked about, a lot of what you're doing is really just making sure that you've got a minimum viable business instead of thinking too hard about that minimum viable product. That makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Now, define a venture scale for our audience, right? Because the media has perpetuated this addiction to unicorn porn, and there's a lot of unicorns that have hit the graveyard, artificial valuations, 100x. And the reality has sunk in the last year after the Black Swan event of COVID ended and that growth didn't sustain and the interest rates went up. But define the reality of venture scale for us today, what that means, so we set some realistic expectations for the audience.
So traditionally, I think the idea behind building a venture scale business was a business that has at least $1 billion market opportunity if you think about the TAM. More recently, some folks were looking at $5 billion, $10 billion plus, right? Which is why you've been seeing those valuations. I don't tend to subscribe to that way of actually looking at a venture scale business, having been part of one. Because the way in which I actually think about it is ultimately customers are voting with their dollars if you're delivering value to them. And I think you want to be able to generate a minimum number of a minimum amount of revenue in order to justify a particular valuation, right? Now, there are some variables there. So if you went back to 2021, where I guess VCs were investing like they were drunk, I wasn't a VC yet, so I could say that, right? They're paying for it now. But let's just say that the multiples were like, sometimes you look around and the multiples would be 40x ARR, 100x ARR, right? So effectively, what you're saying is that the market in the future is going to be, you're going to justify that multiple. Now that number, if you look at Klaviyo, actually, that just IPO'd last week, they had very good business fundamentals, very efficient business. And I'd argue that it's actually probably on the higher end of what a quality business should look like from a fundamental standpoint. You know what the multiple was for Klaviyo? 12x. So I think I don't tend to look too hard at the multiples because that's a little cyclical. I think long term, the real determinant of a business that's venture scale is a business that's able to generate hundreds of millions of dollars, right? It used to be that the line was 100 million ARR. The way I think about it when I look at a new company is, can I see this business getting to 100 million over the next 5, 6, 7 years? And if the answer for me is yes, then I think that's a venture scale business. It's just my way of looking at it in a way that's a lot more, I think, consistent with what long-term value of the business is actually going to be.
Definitely. Now, I like what you said that, right? It's 12x, 10-12x, not 100x. The market has corrected and Klaviyo is as best in class as it gets. So most companies are not at that best in class and they're probably like at a 6 to 8x in this market. And so if you've raised at a, let's say you were 10 million ARR and you raise at 100, not even 100, some of them I've known have raised a half a billion, a billion in valuation. What's happened is if you didn't sustain that growth, you're going to wipe out your whole cap table. So now you're a zombie company. You can't raise. So that is interesting. But thanks for explaining that. I think that venture scale definition is key to understanding. But VC has got a lot of bad rap. But in reality, I put a lot of blame on accelerators, incubators, and advisors out there. And I'll tell you why. The VC map is easy. I'm an LP in a number of funds. Why would I put my money in a venture capital fund? Because I want outsized returns. That's it. I want outsized returns. Now, there's a bigger fish than me, ultra high net worth individuals. There is even beyond that, you got institutions, endowment funds, right? They create impact with that money. They give VCs the money because they want outsized returns. Let me theme out this very clear. If they can't generate an outsized return, I'm putting my money in the index fund or S&P 500. It returns 10% over year over the last 10 years. Year to date, it's 17% up. Yeah. So the VC math is clear. I think what founders, the advice they get is polish your deck to show this large multi-billion dollar TAM. And they're basically coached to polish the TAM to convince the VC to win the deal. What a lot of founders don't get asked to soul search is, what is my personal definition of success? Meaning not money, but what will I do with my money? What is joy for me once I hit success? How much money do I need in my bank account to fund that? is there a version of this company I don't want to work for? Meaning, what values am I compromising for? What are my non-negotiables? And how long do I want to even run a company? So a lot of founders don't soul search that. Then they pitch, then they raise, and they get caught up in this unicorn porn, high valuations, and then they realize, man, I didn't want to do this to begin with, or they sign up for misery. So I think if there's alignment going in, it's like in sales, right? If you tighten your target market and you say a lot of no's, you'll refine your targeting and you'll land the right customers who won't churn later. It's the same thing with VCs and founders. So let's carry on here now.
Can I comment quickly on a couple of things you said there? So I'll say quickly. For one, and this is weird coming from me being in the venture world as well, not every company has to be a unicorn.
Exactly. Right.
Can we just say that to start? Because the reality is, if you build a $100 million company to $100 million company, I think you're still a great entrepreneur, right?
100%.
So fundamentally, but I think it has to do with the expectations of the business, which leads me to your comment about the early stage. I think it's less a function of the stage of funds that do this, but more a function of the size of funds that do this. Because if you're like, we make bets very early into businesses because we're fundamentally very founder focused. And frankly, I think it's okay for some of our companies to have a $100 million exit. That's fine, right? We come in early enough that it's still a decent return for us. But fundamentally, I think what you have when you, for example, are running a seed fund that's a $1 billion fund, the size of your fund makes it so that you can only make bets into outsized type outcomes, potentially. And that's, I think, where that came from, more so than the stage of funds. I think it's about the size of funds early stage that kind of precipitate this, especially also as you get into gross investments as well. You can see, take a look at the IPOs from last week. Take a look at Instacart. I don't think that any investor passed a Series B made any money from that IPO. That's what happens when you want a $30 billion outcome. That doesn't happen. Right, we'll take, move on from this because I know it's a contentious topic. But
yeah, it's a very interesting one, right? I think, you know, great relationships, great companies are built on great alignment. And I keep saying this, the media has perpetuated this addiction to unicorn porn. In reality, the world is run by horses, camels, and donkeys. We need more companies that are building to 100 million ARR, irrespective of the funding, right? If you can build a business capital efficiently to 20, 30 million ARR, it's a great outcome for the founders. Look at us. We bootstrapped Boast over 10 million. We sold half the company. It was bootstrapped 100%. We sold 52%. Me and my co-founder transitioned to the board. We still own close to 40% of the company. Great outcome for us, right? Every other company I've been a part of was venture-backed, raised millions of dollars. They all failed. So that also tells you the odds that since I graduated university, I only worked for startups and either been a part of startups, startup founding teams, they all failed. So the odds are very low, right? And if you look at this math here, VCs at a minimum, no matter, of course, they want to see 100x return, but at a minimum, they want a 3x their valuation. So let's say I invested in your seed round at 10 million. A 30 million exit is reasonable. It'll happen. Let's say I invested in your Series A at 30 million, right? A 90 million exit is reasonable. But once I start investing at 100 million valuation, now all of a sudden, I need to make that math into a 300 million exit. Not many of those happening. Once I start to raise at a 300 million valuation, I'm signing up for an IPO. That's the reality of this situation, right? And how many of those IPOs are happening? We like to see or believe what we see, which is huge volume of IPOs. But the percentage compared to the number of companies that have raised at those valuations is still very low. So that's, I think this is an important conversation to be had, but let's take it back to this, right? So the word product market fit now gets thrown around like a bag of chips. Everyone has a slightly different definition. You've nailed your target market. You've talked about it. You've talked about talking to customers to validate it, figuring out the minimum feature set to deliver that outcome for the customer. But now, what does product market fit mean to you? And what's the journey look like to get there?
You've probably heard different versions of an answer on product market fit that were a little bit more focused on the product. What I'd like to offer today is my sales or go-to-market lens to that, because I think fundamentally, you talk about, a lot of folks talk about go-to-market fit, product market fit, as like your product is starting to delivering this value to customers to the point where there's a pull, right? And I felt that when we're at Hootsuite, like we had a year when all of a sudden we're getting a lot of inbound volume because customers were hearing from other customers that we're helping them with their day-to-day and other things. And those are all things that you can look at from a product standpoint. I tend to believe that the best way to validate that you've built the right product is when a customer renews with you, right? Meaning that they've used your product for a year, for however long that cycle was, and have decided to pay your money again in order to get that value. Now, obviously, that's something that's a bit more of a lagging indicator if you think about it that way, because you don't want to wait around a year, especially if you're in enterprise, to figure out whether you've hit product market fit or not. But the reality is you can actually look at a few leading indicators. So one of the leading indicators, and you can go talk to a lot of product folks and they'll tell you at some of their companies, we knew as an example at Hootsuite that if we had an account that we had something that was like called our Hootsuite App Exchange, which is like you integrate things into the platform. So we knew that the number of integrations that we needed to see from a customer in order to know that they're sticky and getting value was 5 of those integrations. And there are a few things that we look at from a product standpoint to know that customer is likely to remain. If you look at Slack had this thing where they effectively knew that 70% of their customers sent 2,000 plus messages in the first 30 days. And that was a leading indicator to actually seeing that this customer was going to stick around. And I can go over other examples as well. 80% of customers use 5 to 25 features within the first 60 days at HubSpot. You're going to talk to the product folks that tell you some of those things. So fundamentally, when it comes to product market fit, I think that there's a lot of surveys that people do or just do things based on feeling. As I've said at the top of the call, I'm very data driven and I tend to believe in things a lot more scientifically. And I think the best thing, the best proof that you can have that you're successfully delivering value to your customers is when they renew with you. And the best way to figure out your product market fit is to look at the leading indicators that align with customers renewing and then starting looking at those leading indicators.
I love that description. So as a bootstrap founder, as you're in it, Bokar, it always is throwing spaghetti on the wall. When you had an exit or a success, now 20 million ARR, you're looking back and it becomes a framework. And I see all these definitions of NPS and so on. Yeah. And I think to myself, as a bootstrap founder, we had only one metric for product market fit. Do customers pay? And do they stay? Because if they don't stay, I'm not eating. The lights are not on. I don't have the liberty. If I send you this NPS score and it's great, but you don't pay me and you don't put your money where your mouth is, I am done. I love that you say this. And I think this is really key. For me, product market fit is, for me, validation one is you have a message that resonates. They agreed to pay you to try it out. Product market fit is, now they're going to keep paying you and they're not going to leave you, meaning they love the product. All other definitions are great, but ultimately the rubber hits the road when the customer puts the money on the table.
I don't know when we lost our ways, but SaaS always be about renewals, right? It's a subscription business. So your sale doesn't end at like that first sales. What matters is that customer stays with you for a long time. So by definition, a measure of success should be that, in my mind. Are they staying with you? Are they renewing? Are they consistently getting value and impact?
Exactly. Exactly. So here's one thing I want to transition to now. Early stage sales playbook. What does that look like? You come in, let's say you guys are investing at the seed stage often, right? Validated the market. You know what your ICP is. Founder has done some sales. Now, what do we do next? Who do we hire? What does the playbook looks like? Walk me through that.
So I'll take a step back and describe your go-to-market motion in three phases as a business at a high level, right? I think there was sales. I'll just say sales instead of go-to-market, but the reality is it's not. It could be PLD. It could be other things, right? But there's sales when you're searching for product market fit and what that looks like, right? There's sales when you're searching for go-to-market fit and what that looks like. And what I mean by that is you figured out the right product to build to deliver value to the customers, but you haven't actually figured out the right way to the right kind of, you have to build the machine before scaling the machine from a go-to-market standpoint. So step two in my mind is that, and that's what I mean by go-to-market fit, is like you're still figuring out how to build, you're still building a machine. And once you build a machine, there is sales when you're ready to scale and you're scaling, right? At a high level, and I'll go into tactics in a sec, but I'll focus on that 0-to-1 phase first. In my mind, it must be founder-led, right? I don't care whether sales is your background or not. The reality is there's a lot of good reasons why founders should be the initial 500K to a million in revenue, I think, right? And there's reasons for why you want to do that. But really, I think what's is subtle and different here is that I think when you're in that first phase, it's not so much that the goal is selling, the goal is customer success, right? Because of what I said earlier about product market fit, when you think about it, right? So the way in which you operate there is very different than the way in which you operate when you're figuring out how to sell and when you're scaling. It's very different motions, right? So here's what an early kind of motion looks like in my mind. So whether you're in customer development or have a few customers, generally what you want to do is, so suppose you're like going from ideation, you have a first set of conversations with customers to validate that the problem is real, right? The second set of customer conversations is that you go and show them some potential solution to that problem. And they go, you know what, if you build this, I think it's definitely going to solve the problem. Then you start trying to convert some of those folks into design partners. I've alluded to it earlier, that is where the sales start. And what I mean by that is that it's not enough for a customer to have the pain point and like your solution. Fundamentally, especially if you're trying to like get some paid engagement with that customer, you're going to have to go through their buying motion anyway. So at that point is when I think what you have to do is qualify. So one of the things that I coach my founders to do is, because generally what tends to happen is that founders will go and have a conversation, show them a solution or mockups or Figmas, and go, we're building this product. Here's a proposal. Would you like to buy this? And generally they burn cycles doing that and never hear back from these guys that were even, that sounded like they would be potentially open to becoming design partner. The problem there was that you never qualified that customer in the first place. And what I mean by that is, I think a better approach is to go and say, hey, we've had a couple conversations already. And it seems to me that based on our conversations, this could really help address this issue and have a positive impact on your business. What I don't know though, is what would need to be true for you in order to partner with us. We're planning on running a design partner program over the next 3 months. We're only going to work with 5 customers, right? Here's what that's going to entail. Here's what we're going to expect from you. Here's what we're going to do on our end. Have you done this before? Give me a sense as to if you were to bring this up internally, is there a budget set aside for it? Who would we need to bring into this conversation? What would that look like? What I'm doing here, which is not something that you do in a real sales process when you think about it, or a sales process at scale, is that I am the one qualifying customers in, as opposed to what tends to happen, which is folks just trying to persuade people to come into their design partnership. Because here's the thing, as a founder, you have a runway issue, right? Potentially, like you've got a certain amount of time to prove out what you need to prove out. So your best customers that are actually going to be doing things within your time frame, not customers that you're just gonna go to and say, are you open to doing this? And then they'll basically say yes, but, and then they don't have time to work with you for another like 3 to 6 months. So very different motion there. I'll take a quick beat in case you've got any questions, but fundamentally, I think the sale initially is a lot more consultative and it's a lot more like selling a service when you think about it. The difference between selling a product and selling a service is that a product is a product. You say, here it is. It's going to address your pain point. Are you buying it or not? Selling a service is a lot more about, because with a product, like you buy as a customer, you buy the product and you get the value. Whereas with a service, you only buy you only pay for it after you've actually gotten the value when you think about it that way. So that kind of phase one. Happy to move into phase two, but phase one is generally founder-led. Yes, you can have a couple SDRs maybe that help you align conversations, but fundamentally, I'm a strong believer that founders should be the ones doing this, and you should keep your burn low when you're doing it.
I love what you're saying, man. It's like we're two people saying the same thing in different bodies, okay? I made a post on LinkedIn a couple weeks ago that went absolutely viral. It had like 500,000 views. And I'll drop it here for you. But essentially what I said was, this is the absolute best way to bootstrap a company to 1 million ARR. It's in fact how we bootstrap Bose to 10 million with no investor money. UiPath did the same thing in the early days. Basecamp also started this way. Sell a service. Sell a service. Customers want outcomes, not software. When you're selling a service, you get really good at consultative selling and building this sort of trusted partnership relationship with them. You get good at customer success because you can't hide behind buttons and widgets. And then when you deliver that, you know exactly what to build, all the breakpoints, because you've done it manually. Man, this is music to my ears. I'm smiling. I think this is a more capital efficient way to building. It's a disciplined way to building. So let's move on to phase two.
Yeah. So phase two is now starting to work. You've got a few customers. They're using your product. They're getting some value. And you're thinking, okay, it's time to scale this thing. Don't. Please don't scale this thing. I've seen this movie a million times where you got some initial customers to raise some funding and VCs tell you go and hire salespeople, hire a sales leader and go sell. Fundamentally, I think you're in a phase where you're building the engine. And here's what you need to figure out before moving on from this stage is the unit economics. And not to get too into the weeds here, but fundamentally, as you're going through this kind of journey selling to customers, if you have figured out one predictable medium for acquiring leads, because fundamentally go to market at a high level is really about three things: where, who your customers are and where to find them and get in front of them. You know what to do in order to convert them into paying customers. And then you also know how to deliver value in such a way that they renew. Because if you've answered these three questions for one particular medium and the unit economics work, then it's fine. Now, I don't want to overcomplicate the unit economics here because fundamentally all I mean is you know what inputs will lead to what outputs. A few pointers. Generally speaking, if you've got a couple sales reps, as an example, a benchmark is that those sales reps should be delivering at least 3x OTE, their OTE, in order for you to know that you're doing something right. Meaning that if you're paying a sales rep 200K a year, they're bringing in at least 600K. Or best in class companies are at 5x, 6x, right? But fundamentally, 3x, the number that these reps are getting paid is a good benchmark as an example. I actually have a full write-up on this and I call them the minimum viable metrics for go-to-market fit. And I've got some minimum viable metrics for product market fit as well. But really what I've tried to highlight is what does good conversion look like from a pipeline standpoint? What does good the percentage that you're getting from your reps look like in terms of money? So to say, I can share this with the audience a little bit later, but fundamentally it's about getting to the essential benchmark that are the minimum workable benchmarks to get to a model that's actually going to scale in such a way that it can be optimized later. Doesn't have to be perfect, but you do have to figure out a way to get more out of your motion than you put in effectively. So even if you're at 1x, that's already starting to work, but really figure out how to get there. The type of sales leader that may work here, but you don't necessarily need to hire a sales leader. So this is typically where you're at Series A, is somebody who has actually built a motion at an early stage company before, right? And the reason why I was saying that it's important for the founders to do the founder-led selling initially is that the best way for you to know what kind of leader to hire is because you've actually looked at that motion and built that initial motion. And really what you want is somebody who can build this into something that can be scalable. And that's a skill set of its own as well. So that's getting to go to market fit. I'll take a quick beat here again in case you wanted me to expand on anything before I move on to scaling. But generally, I think of it as product market fit, you're between zero and a million. Go-to-market fit, believe it or not, you're probably not at go-to-market fit even until, like, I've seen companies at 10 million AR plus that still haven't figured out the motion. But generally, that's when you figure it out. So that's Series A to Series B. And then once you figured out the minimum viable metrics that make a business workable, then the next step is optimization and scaling, and that's typically Series B plus, but that's where it becomes a lot more what people actually expect, right, when it comes to selling.
I love those definitions because it brings a lot of calm. Oftentimes we try to boil the ocean here, right? Do so many things, but it's pretty clear. Phase one, you got to validate. Then you got to get to product market fit. Then you got to figure out a repeatable channel to grow. And when you've done those, meaning one kind of customer coming through one kind of channel, getting one kind of value, then you can scale. You can pour 75% fuel on the fire and then 25% try new things, new markets, new products, new technologies. And again, at scale, when people raise money, they dump everything and the kitchen sink and say, okay, I'm going to figure out a new market, but I'm also going to figure out a new product and I'm also going to figure out a new channel. And that causes so much trouble.
One predictable medium, and I didn't say this, but I always say this, and it's very controversial. I think in a lot of cases, your VP of customer success should be your first hire, not your VP of sales. Because again, your scaling the company depends on your customer story and your success stories. So you better make sure that those customers are renewing, and because that's going to be effectively what will help you scale. But at a high level, you got it exactly right. It's a lot of times people think that scaling is about selling to more markets for more customers. No, I think the way I think about it is, and this is, by the way, part of my role at Hootsuite. I tend to think of go-to-market in terms of two types of teams all the time. You get a team that's figuring out how to sell into a new market or sell a new product. And you get a team that's really just like a team that's executing on something that's a proven model that they're just scaling, right? If you don't separate those two things out is when you start running into issues as a sales leader. Because what tends to happen, especially if you're working with a leader that hasn't done that 0-to-1 motion, is that they'll come to you and say, and I've seen this movie a million times, it's like, all right, so we're at 5 million AR. Show me who your customers are, right? And they'll go and figure out who the customers are and go, okay, let me go and find more of these types of customers. Whereas when I'm looking at it, what I'm thinking is I've talked to 30 different customers and heard 30 different reasons for why they bought. That's a red flag to me. That's not a reason to scale into these customer bases. What I actually want is one predictable medium and motion. And I know that there's enough customers to have reps sell into and they already know what to say. And that's when you're scaling. And then you'll have another team. We used to call it our tiger teams. And the tiger teams are very different. A tiger team is a team that's figuring out a market or a product. It's not a team that's selling into a market that hasn't been sold into yet. Those teams are the right type of usual setup of like SDR, AE, and here's the playbook, go. If you got a new market, I don't advise going in with your kind of existing team because fundamentally the skill set I think there is different.
Definitely. Now, at what point do you bring on a sales leader, right? You said your first hire should be customer success. I agree because in that first phase, retention is key. If they don't keep paying you, you don't have product market fit. But at what point do you bring on a sales leader and what are the key traits of finding this sales leader?
Yeah, so here's kind of how I think about it. And I think in a very structured way, what you want to do is kind of like when you think about the revenue engine, or I think let me actually think about it more in terms of the sales playbook, and then I'll take it to another level there. If you get a good prospecting guide and playbook, meaning like you got your target account list, you know what your messaging is, you know what sequences work, yada, yada, that means that you can predictably build pipeline, right? So that's job one, right? At that point, your next job is to figure out what your discovery playbook is, right? Meaning you know what questions to ask, you know what, like you have a qualifying matrix, right? Ideally, you even have a library of customer calls so that you can train people on that, right? Meaning that now you know how to find pipeline and you know how to qualify the pipeline. At that point, you can actually hire an SDR, right? Why? Because you can just give them the playbook and say, go. And now as a founder, if you're in the founder-led motion, you're the one basically taking in those first calls and moving down to a close, right? But let me keep going with the playbook. Now you know exactly what to do with customers and you've got like a sales playbook, right? Meaning how to go from a qualified lead to optimizing your chances of closing that customer, right? Maybe you've got like a presentation like guide, you've got all sorts of things that you're doing, but fundamentally, really what I'm describing there is you effectively decoding this kind of machine so that every single step of that thing is predictable right along the way. So once you're at that point where you know exactly like what the right sales playbook is, then you can start hiring some AEs. The good thing as a founder, if you're leading this team, is that because you've ideally been the one leading those first AEs, you know exactly what kind of leader you need for those AEs, don't you? Because now you can start thinking about like the actual job and what it entails and hiring reps for that specific job based on the skill sets, right? Then you know what manager to hire. Notice that I'm sequencing this out. I am not so much saying that it happens at seed or it happens at series B. I'm going with just like you're decoding the playbook, right? All the way to like having a customer success playbook. Now to answer the question, I think once you do that, so suppose you've done this in the right order and you have now maybe like a first line manager that's working with you. Ideally, this is somebody that's like a director type person who's got the potential to become like a sales leader so that you can, instead of hiring your VP of sale at your Series A, you can then up level later by hiring an actual professional CRO who's very good at scaling companies, right? Because fundamentally, I think that first VP of sales should be like a playbook builder, right? That's why you hear people telling you don't hire this person from Salesforce because they've never had to build the playbook. They've just been given the playbook to run. That's what you want to be mindful of. But generally, just to give some pointers, that tends to happen once you've had at least about like a million plus in sales, because at that point you would have had some good customer success stories to talk about, right? And then you can build on that to figure out the right motion, and then you can start scaling from there. But fundamentally, I think you can think of this in a very sequenced out way, really.
Let's dive into the tooling. I like how you laid it out. Everything is very practical, very methodical, not boiling the ocean, phase by phase. It's patience, right? And what that also does, when you boil the ocean, you get thrown into this chaos. It feels like you're doing work, but a lot of the times it's busy work. It's not moving the needle. Good work is focused, right? Validates. Get to retention. Figure out a repeatable, scalable channel. Then figure out a new medium or a new product. It's calm, it's focused, right? And then you know the right kind of leader to hire, the right kind of product to build. Now, what are you seeing in the GTM space today? There's this huge proliferation of AI and chatbots and ChatGPT, and AI is in every conversation. So we can't finish this conversation on GTM without understanding what are you seeing out there? How are you advising companies to take advantage of AI?
First off, I'll preface this by saying that it's very exciting what's going on in the AI space today, especially as it applies to selling, because there's a lot of busy work when it comes to selling still, right? Despite all the tooling, right, it's still very hard to sell and it still requires quite a bit. Here's what I would say, and here's how I would caution things after saying that. I see a tendency already for folks to use the AI tools to automate and do things at scale. There's nothing wrong with that. What I would caution is just do the thing manually first. And then if it works, scale it. Because the reality is, if you're doing something bad and automating it at scale, you're just doing bad at scale as well. So fundamentally, these tools are not there to fundamentally change the way in which you interact with customers in that sense, right? Customers still have problems and customers still want to solve their problems and don't care about your product in a lot of cases, right? But there's some exciting tools out there. I tend to think that the current incumbent solutions are actually going to be the ones doing the best job here. Like, you can already start looking at how companies like Outreach are incorporating AI tooling. Even Salesforce, that traditionally has been slow at incorporating AI into their tool set, Salesforce is putting in a lot of interesting tools there. So it's HubSpot, right? So from that perspective, I think very interesting to look at how you can use AI and automation to scale some of the things that you're doing and reduce the busy work from a prospecting standpoint, from a customer intelligence standpoint and surfacing things, from a demo even sales point. I've seen some AIs put together custom demos for customers, which is really what sales engineers do, but in a way that is a lot easier to do than any other thing. But fundamentally, I think my cautions there still is do the thing manually first, and then once it works, scale it would be the thing that I would say. But the tooling is exciting. I'm actually particularly excited about the type of tooling that's not about facilitating so much the sales motion from a sales enablement standpoint. But I tend to believe that the future of sales enablement is actually customer enablement. Enable your customers to buy in ways that haven't been explored before. And I think when you look at the PLG trend, clearly that's where things should be headed, right? And also I'm excited about the type of tooling that helps people managers, because fundamentally sales is still about a human convincing another human to buy technology. Unless we get to a point where AI is a buying software, I think you're still going to eventually end up with some kind of steak dinner. I know it sounds like a weird thing to say, but you can look at PLG companies long-term and see where they end up. You'll have a sales motion eventually anyway.
Very well said. Now, any tool names that you can throw out that your favorites 3 to 5 that are defining how you think about helping teams with their GTMs?
There's my answer now and what I think my answer tomorrow will be.
So let's hear both.
My answer now is there are tools out there that are very good at what they do. Fundamentally, I think Outreach is really good when it comes to sales engagement. I think Gong is very good when it comes to helping you with conversational intelligence. I think HubSpot, Salesforce are up there still when it comes to CRM, even though I find myself liking HubSpot a lot more. But fundamentally, there's really good tools everywhere. And even on the sales intelligence side, Apollo is really good now. LinkedIn has some great things. But my answer for tomorrow is actually looking at the AI lens a little bit more, because fundamentally, the sales stack is still pretty, like, those tools don't play with each other when you think about it, right? Because everybody's trying to own that kind of use case. I think what would be the most helpful long-term when you think about data and AI is that the integrated tool that's going to be able to really follow that customer and sales motion from point one to the end is going to be the best tool that's going to win out, meaning that the tooling that has the best data across the board about that journey is going to win. Jira is still out, but I'm starting to see some really interesting things from HubSpot and Outreach when it comes to that. But again, Jira is still out on that.
Now, one piece of unconventional advice on sales that founders typically ignore but shouldn't.
A lot of being a good founder is actually about being a very good SDR. I know it sounds like a weird thing to say, but the reality is a lot of your job is going to be talking to people and reaching out to people. I'm not even talking about customers only. Think about yourself as a founder. You have to sell to prospective employees, right? You have to pitch VCs. And a lot of that motion is being able to find the right people, getting in front of them, and making sure that they're the right people that you're talking to. And that really is an SDR role when you think about it.
I couldn't say this more, man. I am everything I am because of that first cold calling job I had. Yeah. And 95% of our speakers for our traction conferences, and we've had the CEO of Twilio, HubSpot, Atlassian, all the big names in tech were cold emails. Yeah. Every market that we went into with Boast was a cold email. Even like driving sales for this book was email. It was all SDRing. Literally, as a founder, and this is how most founders delude ourselves, right? We put on these titles and we try to live up to these titles. You talked about validation, product market fit, product channel fit, and then scale. At Validation, you're an individual contributor as a founder. That's what you are SDRing.
Yeah.
At product market fit, maybe you are a manager. You hire two salespeople and you're still an SDR++. You're still doing a lot of outreach. Like I even landed to promote my book on 90 podcasts in the last 10 weeks. I cold emailed 200 podcasters to do that and repeatedly through a sequence. So you're like now maybe a manager. At product channel fit, you've have more reps. So maybe you hired a manager to manage those reps. So you turn into a VP. You're still executing. Nowhere are you focused on high level strategy because you're focused on the thing. One customer, one value, one channel. A lot of people just abstract themselves to being C-suite and they're so disconnected from the business trying to be the C-suite. But you're absolutely right. A lot of what a founder does is an SDR. So, you know, kudos to you, man, for giving props to this phenomenal role. Where do we follow your wisdom?
I'm part of Forum now. So we invest in 100, we write 100 checks here into early stage of pre-seed seed companies. And we've got an accelerator too, where we help them with go to market and fundraising. So that's forumvc.com if you want to pitch us there. But I'm pretty easy to find on LinkedIn and other channels. My LinkedIn is, I'm really easy to find. It's Bocar Dia, B-O-C-A-R, last name D-I-A. There won't be a lot of people that have that name on LinkedIn, so you can find me there. And I'm also on Twitter, but hit me up on LinkedIn or contact form. Those are the best ways to get a hold of me.
Awesome. And you, I think you said that you were a technical guy turned sales, right? Your background is in engineering or computer science?
Yeah.
What kind of engineering was it?
Computer engineer.
Yeah, same like me. So let me ask you this. Were there any books you read in those early days that helped you along the way?
About computer engineering on the sales side? Because I actually...
On the sales side.
So funnily enough, there's a few books that I always recommend. Funnily enough, if Mark Rebers from HubSpot, guess what he was before he was a sales leader? He was an engineer, right? A lot of the kind of new gen sales leaders are actually very technical and data driven, right? He's got a book that's called The Sales Acceleration Formula. Read it. There's another book that's a lot more tactical for founders by Peter Kasemji. That's Founder Selling, where he breaks down how you do specific things. That's always a book that I recommend. And then if you haven't looked into the work of Winning by Design, Jacko and team, they've got a very like data-driven scientific way of approaching things as well. And they've got a few different books on the topic, but go over to Winning by Design and see some of the books that they've got. They've got one that's specifically for founders, and then you'll have one that's about SDRs, one that's about AEs, one's about customer success, and those books are just invaluable.
Bocar, what's funny is we're meeting after hanging out in the same circles. We know the same people. I've been to a lot of Peter Kasemji's events, hung out with them. Mark Roborich has been to two or three of my contraction conferences. And of course, Jaco, I know, and his partner there, Julie, and she's been to our events as well. So we're hanging out in the same circles. I'm surprised we haven't met in Vancouver, but we're meeting over the wire here. So great to have you. What a wonderful conversation. Very refreshing, because this is what people need to know to build a capital efficient business. Thank you so much, my man. Wishing you great success. Love and peace.
This episode is brought to you by Boast.ai. Each year, the US and Canadian governments give out billions of dollars in R&D tax credits and innovation incentives to fund businesses like yours. But the application process is cumbersome, prone to frustrating audits, and receiving the money can take up to 16 months. Boast.ai gets you access to research and development tax credits and innovation funding opportunities without the headache and red tape. Join thousands of North American companies leveraging Boast.ai software to maximize cashback. Check out www.boast.ai.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this week's episode of the Traction Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star review. And you can find more information and all the resources mentioned in today's episode at boast.ai. That's boast.ai/blog. No, I've done some silly shit, focused on the tech stack, thinking it was brilliant. Now I know that it's no way for you to build a unicorn. You need distribution to get